emasculated me by making the chair. He's now trying to ruin my career. One of the old rules was never let a conference not go for its lunch. He's extended the time until 1:10. I'll stop at 1:10. I'd like to thank all five speakers and many, many congratulations. My agents only gave 3 yellow cards out of 5, which is a testament to their sort of brevity. I'd like to just take up one immediate comment in Ricky's presentation, and that's about the river, the great underused asset of London. And I know Richard Layard wants to say a few words. Can you make each of your comments when people come, you know, no more than a couple of minutes, sure. And then another Richard. We're flooded by Richards.
One of the major problems with the river is the tide. And when the tide is in, the river is just wonderful, and I think it's as uplifting as Venice or anywhere in the world. And when it's out, the river is a dump, which is why we've underused it. If the tide was always in, the river would be the centre, the social centre of the city. All the cafes would be there, social life. It would be a completely different city, more like some of the great European cities that are built on rivers. So if you want to see what the difference would be, you just have to go to Richmond. Now, 100 years ago, the citizens of Richmond decided they didn't want the tide going out, and they built a barrier that stops it going out, and that's why it's so beautiful at Richmond. People may not know this. For the rest of London, we already have a barrier at Woolwich that could be raised and stop the tide going out. Nearly all the objections are incredibly weak. For example, the birds wouldn't like it. I want to put people before birds. As I say, it took the citizens of Richmond 30 years to overcome the Thames Conservancy and all the conservative opposition. Why don't we try and do it for the rest of London by the time of the Olympics?
More, sir. Thank you for that helpful contribution, which is why I wanted you to speak. Richard Sennett.
And can you just introduce yourselves? You know, I know who he is, but everybody else might not.
Just press the button.
Come on, Richard. You're an expert.
No, such a difficult person. I wanted to make a comment about Gerald Frug's presentation, which seems to me very, very important. The word partnership is also a way of devaluing conflict in the city. And one of the issues that seems to me to be very important in understanding the future of cities is how to legitimate certain forms of conflict. We can only assume that we get rid of conflict as a problem, that we resolve conflict, if we assume that ultimately the interests of a city can be resolved into one solution that's best for the majority. That is, that cities are not structured by irreparable differences. In my view, that's, if it was ever realistic, it has very little to do with the kinds of cities that are coming into being. And our problem, therefore, is how to learn to dwell in constant conflict, how to have a political process which continually expresses difference of class, race, ethnicity, religion, ways of life, so that these are not resolved. We have very few ways of thinking about dwelling in permanent conflict as a positive experience. But unless we start thinking about those ways of dwelling in permanent conflict and about politics as a medium for permanent conflict, not as a resolution for it, I think we create essentially a frozen, static, dead city.
Sophie, I really appreciate, and all of us, the Parisian reflections on Anne Powers?
Well, I'm going to just follow what Richard said. It was fascinating for me this morning to come through London by cab and to discover that there were maximum security schemes preventing anyone to function smoothly in the city. Most roads were blocked. You had to go endlessly through detours to try to get to your goal. Same today in Paris, it's exactly the same, maybe for different reasons. Although in the two places, we celebrate a mega event, which is, as you know, the war's consequences. But why is that so? And I think that in the two cities, the same deep causes are not addressed, although the modes of approach are very different. The major causes of unrest, disorders, disruptions are not addressed, which means that there are a lot of youngsters who are poor and of different origin who feel they do not belong here and there. They are not part of, and they may have been school dropouts, they are unemployed, their families experiences crisis. And the mainstream societies and the government certainly have not been able to tell them that we could not live without them, that they had a future in the country. And from this moment on, and Anne said that very very clearly too, there are two options, and the two options concern our two cities, Paris and New York. Either they are going to instrumentalize violence and express their rage and act out, and maybe this will be a prelude to further negotiations, let's hope so. Or they can be tempted by fundamentalism because they are a lost generation and anyway, they have nothing to hope now. And they think that religion is going to fulfill their needs for belonging and for getting something. And in the two societies, we have exactly this. And now what do we do about that? And what very specific question I would like to ask you is, do we communicate about how we cities try to cope with threats, or do we keep it silent? Is there a virtue to keep our processes of preparation silent? And I would like the experts to tell me what they think about it.
Can anybody volunteer to join me in saying never keep silent? Can somebody come in just on and answer that question? Please, sir.
Yes, absolutely. And well, I agree with this analysis, as we did also yesterday in our conferences. And I agree fully with the recept of never be silent. You have to bring it at the table, and you have to discuss it, and that's the only way to bridge the gap.
Yeah, well, I just want to say I totally disagree. And in fact, we present ourselves very clearly. The two real poles of development in Europe are what I would call the Parisian model, whose results we can see at the moment, and the model which put in London. I always summarize it in a speech very simply. The attitude of Paris towards, I caricature, I'm being rude,
yes,
and aggressive, but is to foreign companies, to foreigners, your money is very welcome, but please leave your culture behind you. London's approach is your money is very, very welcome, and we assume you're going to bring your culture with you. And we think that that will aid to the creativity of our city. What happens in Paris today, or in France, no, let's not reduce it to Paris, today, in my judgment, is essentially what London went through in about 1981, which was an attempt culturally and physically to smash the immigrant population into submission. And the result, because people do not accept to be treated like animals, was exactly the same in London in the 1980s, which is rioting. Since 1981, when the police suffered a military defeat, the entire policy of policing and the approach to the city has turned round to the multicultural policy that we have today. In my opinion, the approach which France has on this and other parts of Europe that follow the model will just go through 20 years of the same pain, the that we went through until we learned a more sensible way to conduct ourselves.
Just one word.
Through the chair.
About the cab driver who told me, we know in this country, I mean, this is really a sort of field experience. The cab driver said, in this country, we have all these preachers of hatred. They live in £500,000 mansions, and the families are on benefits. I don't know where we are going. We are heading into a war. So I suppose that there are diverse opinions about that.
But there are no riots going on at the moment, and neither are there going to be.
You indicated by the slightest movement of your eyebrow.
To actually refer to what I thought was an excellent presentation by Gerald Frug, and I think it's most important. Extremely difficult to respond in any depth given the time, but The Economist, fairly recently, not known to be the most liberal of institutions, remarked on, in effect, that a strong public sector is essential to a successful private sector. And I think in that regard, the globalization talk about is the nation state dying or is it having to take a back seat should raise some concerns for us if, in fact, that hypothesis is correct. The second point is, and it's related, they're all actually related, who takes the risk in regard to large infrastructure projects, for example? The point about partnership is well taken. If you look at the long-term risks, the public sector seems to be taking much of the brunt of that. And the private sector is brought in to take short-term risk. But the truth of the matter is only by having the public sector look at the long-term risks and getting its pound of flesh back for that will any true harmony and partnership take place. Which leads on to the next point about public transport. Anne Pound's talked about affordability in housing and is well known for raising this. It's long overdue to talk about affordable transport, affordable public transport, and affordable public transport is environmentally sensitive. And by charging a tax on peak travel does not seem to me to be the way to go about that. Finally, the whole issue of commodification of public space. We're now not only seeing public space being commodified by the private sector as foreign investors plow into London, but we're seeing the commodification of movement space. And I do think we're losing really the vision of our city as a cohesive entity if we start going down that route. Thank you.
Anne Power, then Tony, then lunch.
Sorry, I've done it.
Barricades in a minute.
I would like to put a bit of a chastening damper on the contribution from London following Sophie's short statement. The British National Party made its biggest electoral gains in May 2005 in Barking, East London, which was one of the areas I referred to. And it made those gains because of the huge racial tension, because of the sense of invasion, because of the sense of being chased out, because of the sense of losing out. London may well diffuse its problems by actually pushing white people out of the city at a huge rate, which is what's happening at the moment. And I really wouldn't like us to be complacent. I hope that the Greater London Authority wins. I think it's giving out the most fantastically positive messages, and may it long continue. I also think that the police, in many ways, one of our areas, the police have done very, very, very intensive additional policing in order to cope with the huge boom in violent crime and youth disorder within that area, only half a mile from the City of London, only 3 years ago. So I really, really think that, as Ricky explained, we're in, what did you call it, creative disorder or positive, you know, anyway. And youth disorder the disorder of young people, of the families we talk to, is the biggest single threat that the families articulate. They don't articulate it negatively. They say we've got to do more for young people. But nobody's got the answer to that. And other cities in this country, from Birmingham upwards, rioted only 5 years ago, and it was a very healthy warning to London. So I would not really be so brave as to say we're home and dry. We're a very different culture from the French, and we have learned a lot of lessons from our hideous colonial past, but...
Aye, aye.
Tony.
I mean, it was interesting when Gerald mentioned the word partnerships in the way he did, there was a sort of laugh of approval around the room, because it is understood, I think, in Britain that New Labour has enormously overused this notion of partnership. But it is worth understanding that the present government in Britain is using partnerships in part to create institutions that they imagine will improve the quality of public services through the use of another appalling cliche, which is joining up public services. There's a great deal of that rhetoric from New Labour politicians. But what this is also doing is legitimizing the creation of new institutions at the local level. There are things called local strategic partnerships, which bring together all the local manifestations of what used to be called local government into local governance. And they are evidence of successive British government from Mrs. Thatcher to Mr. Blair, which has no confidence in local political institutions. They simply no longer believe that they work, and they are undermining what Badgett called the checks and balances in the British Constitution, but they're doing it deliberately. They are creating new forms of political institutions which are not democratically elected, and they know what they're doing. They know what they're doing. So it is not kind of stumbling purely for the reasons outlined. It's part of a wider, longer-term political effort to change the balance of power within the UK Constitution.
Thank you very much. What we've now had this morning, without shaping anything too early, is, I think, some absolutely fascinating presentations and some most thoughtful contributions from the floor, albeit on over not long enough time. What we now do this afternoon is basically bear in mind and reflect over your lunch over what the speakers have said, and then, if you like, try to apply some of the points that you're holding to the four case studies. If you like, we're trying to cross a bridge here. We've got the speakers have successfully got us to one end. We've now got to cross it and discover what we see the other side. Can I invite you to show your appreciation to the five excellent speakers? And can I invite you to share the Greater London Authority's hospitality, which is immediately outside, and reconvene here on the dot, Ricky, at 2:30. Thank you very much.